Welcome to The Metabolic Link, a medical and science-focused podcast that explores the common thread of metabolism in health and disease. This is where science meets society. Hi, everyone. Welcome back to another episode, The Metabolic Link. Really excited to be sitting down here with you both again today. We've got some really interesting papers to go through. But first, I'm your co-host, Victoria Field, along with my amazing co-host, Dr. Dominic D'Agostino and Dr. Angela Poff. And we are going to be exploring some really interesting research today. One paper specifically has to do with Parkinson's disease. That's really fascinating. And the second is the ketogenic diet for mental illness. First, before we dive into mental illness, we're going to cover this Parkinson's paper. And Angela, you're going to lead us off with what we're looking at today.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, so this is a pretty cool paper. It is titled The Anti-Inflammatory Effect of Preventative Intervention with Ketogenic Diet, Mediated by the Histone Acetylation of mGlu-R5, it's a glutamate receptor, promoter region in rat Parkinson's disease model, a dual tracer PET study. So this came out of, the Huazhong University of Science and Technology in Wuhan, China. And so this came out, when was it published? September 2022. Thanks, Tom. Okay, awesome. So this is a really cool study. So essentially, this study sought to test the therapeutic effects of ketogenic diet, and specifically looking at, does it make a difference if you apply the ketogenic diet prior to or after onset of Parkinson's disease in this rat model? So Parkinson's disease is a highly prevalent disease. There's over 6 million people worldwide that have it, but it's the fastest growing neurological disease in terms of prevalence. We know the fundamental feature of Parkinson's disease. It's characterized by the loss of dopaminergic neurons in the substantia nigra of the mesencephalon, but we don't really understand exactly why that's happening. It's thought that maybe neuroinflammation is playing a role. So they see reactive microglia found in that substantia nigra region of Parkinson's patients. So microglia are like the resident macrophages of the central nervous system. So this is an immune cell. But these cells are activated inappropriately in this condition, and they are associated with brain injury and neuroinflammation. So when you have these activated microglia, they express this protein called TSPO, and that can be measured with PET imaging and used as a marker of neuroinflammation. So this is helpful because in these animal models, you can actually measure neuroinflammation in real-time living animals, which is helpful in a study like this. So they did this because, of course, the ketogenic diet has been shown to be broadly neuroprotective. There's several mechanisms that have been reported whereby the ketogenic diet or nutritional ketosis in general might suppress inflammation. So some of those being inhibition of the assembly of the NLRP3 inflammasome, which is a part of the immune system that incites inflammation. This is a good thing when it happens in properly controlled conditions and it's doing its job right, but it also gets hyperactivated at the wrong time chronically in a lot of disease states and in aging. And then also ketogenic diet influences the expression of genes through epigenetic regulation. So the primary ketone, beta-hydroxybutyrate, is a histone deacetylase inhibitor, and it can cause regulation of gene expression and increased histone acetylation that can have downstream effects to reduce inflammation. So in the study, they had two groups of rats. Half of them, they pre-treated with the ketogenic diet for 4 weeks and then induced Parkinson's disease in these rats. And they did this by injecting LPS, lipopolysaccharide, into the substantia nigra of their brains, and that caused death of those neurons there, which is, again, that classic hallmark feature of Parkinson's disease. So one group was treated with ketogenic diet before that happened. The other group was treated with this regular higher carbohydrate rodent chow up until the point where Parkinson's disease was induced, and then they were switched to a ketogenic diet immediately after that. They performed 4 weeks later, so after 4 weeks after the Parkinson's was induced. They did PET imaging to look at the neuroinflammation. They did motor function testing, and they collected a whole bunch of tissues and did a bunch of biochemical assays on them to see what's going on. So generally speaking, the results were both of the ketogenic diet groups exhibited improved motor function compared to the animals that had been eating a standard diet prior to the Parkinson's disease onset. But specifically, the ketogenic diet that was preventative, the KDP, did better than the rats that didn't get the diet until after disease onset. They also saw improvements in the neuroinflammation via the PET imaging, that in specifically the preventative treatment, but not the after-the-fact intervention. They also saw that, again, only the preventative version of the ketogenic diet and not the therapeutic in terms of after the disease had already occurred, lessened the upregulation of pro-inflammatory cytokines like TNF-alpha, IL-1 beta, and IL-6 in that region of the brain. They also saw prevention of neuronal loss in the substantia nigra, again, only in the animals that had been pre-treated with the ketogenic diet. Both of the diet groups did see a reduction in the number of TSPO-positive microglia, so those activated microglia in the substantia nigra, but the benefit was more was greater in the ones that were treated preventatively. And they also saw increased acetylation of some important relevant genes like that glutamate receptor that we were talking about in both of the groups. That again trended, but not statistically significant, trended higher in the preventative group versus when the diet was administered after the fact. So, you know, the authors really conclude that this was some pretty striking preclinical results to show the ketogenic diet can elicit therapeutic benefits on a wide variety of markers in a Parkinson's disease model. But they said we really have to think of it as maybe more of a preventative intervention in susceptible populations because the result was so much more striking.
And this is exciting because current treatment for Parkinson's, I think we should maybe kind of touch a little bit more on what's available to people. Not much in terms of, I mean, of course, you've got some treatments that are designed to, you know, tackle sort of dopamine or at least increase potentially dopamine levels. But if you guys want to explain a little bit more about the current treatment strategy and why this anti-inflammatory potential, you know, in this, what the researchers explored could be this exciting new way to maybe not necessarily during, like once you've got that dopaminergic damage like already happening, but maybe pre, you know, you have maybe there's like some sort of, you know, somebody in your family has Parkinson's or something like that. You have some information that might be advisable for you to do it. If you guys could explain the difference between, you know, what the current treatment is and where we could be headed with this.
As a preventative, yeah. And I think that's super important and it's not really taught at all. I do teach the dopaminergic section for neuropharmacology. So this ties in well. And I usually pick a paper that, so I'm going to, I didn't read this one, but I'm going to include this in my discussion in the class. In regards to Parkinson's disease, we know that the neurons, the dopaminergic neurons within the substantia nigra, are selectively vulnerable to oxidative stress. And that's due to a number of different reasons. They do produce an enzyme called monoamine oxidase. And in the context of ischemia or reperfusion or agents that are mitochondrial toxins, specifically in the past, there have been a variety of different pesticides that have been used in different countries, and people within these countries experience Parkinson's disease, and that's because the pesticide inhibits the mitochondria at the complex one, and that produces superoxide, and then superoxide can drive other reactive intermediates. So the neurons within the substantia nigra really are, we know that they're selectively vulnerable to oxidative stress, and that actually led, when I was in grad school, a number of my friends were studying Parkinson's disease and they're using a model, kind of ties into this. It was MPTP. So that's actually the classical model that was used to study Parkinson's disease. And It's in a way a sad story that a drug was developed that was an opioid-like drug administered and a bunch of people got Parkinson's disease, and that's because it was driving these pro-inflammatory reactive oxygen species pathways that was selectively killing the neurons in the substantia nigra. And then fast forward a few years later, that MPTP molecule then became like the standard for Parkinson's disease model. And there are some sort of caveats to its use, but it's still used today as a model. And it does it just by driving reactive oxygen species and inflammation. So lipopolysaccharide, LPS, can also do the same thing and produce what some may call like a pseudo Parkinson's disease, because it's, you know, exacerbating it in a very expedited fashion. Yeah. But LPS has been used at University of South Florida actually as a model to induce Alzheimer's disease. So injecting LPS into the brain or systemically produces neuroinflammation, systemic inflammation that contributes to the accumulation of amyloid and tau plaques in Alzheimer's disease in mouse models. So there is a correlation too with people who have Alzheimer's disease and that pathology, including amyloid and tau, and having Parkinson's disease. So there's a mm-hmm. correlation there.
And just real quick, I think it could be interesting, if you're not familiar, LPS is like basically part of like bacteria membrane. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And this is used as a way to elicit like the immune response that occurs to an infection without actually having the infective pathogen present. And so it's used in a lot of model systems to cause this kind of abnormal or exacerbated, very dramatic immune response. And, you know, just from hearing, you know, Dom mention in this paper today, used that there's LPS is used to induce a lot of different disease models, which for me is very telling of how important inflammation is in the development of these diseases. You can literally mimic a lot of these chronic diseases with targeted just inflammation in a specific part of the body.
And the previous work that was done, and this ties into ketones, beta-hydroxybutyrate specifically, was a study done at Yale in Deep Dixit's lab, where a ketogenic diet and a ketone supplementation was used to specifically elevate beta-hydroxybutyrate. And this was published in 2015 or 16, and it showed that beta-hydroxybutyrate could inhibit the activation of the NLRP3 inflammasome. And in doing so, that the activation of that inflammatory complex then initiates the release and activation of inflammatory cytokines, one of them being IL-1 beta, so which is highly pro-inflammatory, neuroinflammatory, so contributes significantly to the suppression of the activation of that inflammatory complex. I realized that just now that I didn't address a question that Victoria asked, which is about the treatment of Parkinson's disease. So the standard treatment of Parkinson's disease is actually to administer the precursor for dopamine, and that would be L-DOPA. So if you move back, actually phenylalanine is an amino acid, an essential amino acid that's found in our diet, contributes to enzymatically converted to tyrosine. And the catecholaminergic pathway is such that through tyrosine hydroxylase, which is kind of like the rate limiting enzymatic step for dopamine synthesis, will then contribute to ultimately the production of dopamine. But farther down that path is L-DOPA. When you consume L-DOPA, you have that converts to dopamine. So what you want to do pharmacologically is to get dopamine elevated in the brain, but not the periphery. So a small dose of dopamine can actually cause an increase or decrease in blood pressure, depending upon how it's the peripheral concentration of it. So dopamine is co-administered with another drug called carbidopa. Carbidopa inhibits the enzymatic process of the L-DOPA converting to dopamine in the periphery. So you get more penetration of L-DOPA across the blood-brain barrier. And so you can significantly increase brain levels of dopamine when it's co-administered with carbidopa. And you can, if you gave a whopping dose of L-DOPA, you would cause very significant side effects on blood pressure and autonomic regulation. To avoid that, it's co-administered with carbidopa. So this is like the standard of care treatment for Parkinson's disease, and it works usually in a very robust way and highly efficacious way initially. But as the dopaminergic neurons degenerate due to a variety of different causes, typically linked to oxidative stress and neuroinflammation and other factors, you need to have about... So this is kind of very striking when I was learning about Parkinson's. About 80% of the neurons within the substantia nigra ultimately are dead or are dying before symptoms of Parkinson's disease mm-hmm. manifest. So it would be, you know, ideal to prevent that from happening in the first place. So that's why I'm kind of even more enthusiastic about this idea of, you know, administering a neuroprotective strategies to prevent that from happening. It would be a great if there was a window in the brain where we could, you know, look at this very small region of dopaminergic neurons. The dopaminergic nuclei within the brain comprise only 3-4% of the total amount of neurons in the brain, but they go everywhere and they have tremendous effects on motivation, on addiction, on learning and memory, and the neural control of autonomic regulation. And that includes respiratory function and also cardiovascular function. So a very small group of neurons, and they project to a wide variety of different nuclei, including areas associated, you know, with addiction. So it was, you know, kind of reassuring that a ketogenic diet through mechanisms, and I don't know mechanistically how they, you know, went into understanding how it was working, but we know that the ketogenic diet can help to restore and balance neurotransmitter systems. It can reduce reactive oxygen species, and it has this reduction in reducing effect on inflammatory cascades that could be contributing to
yeah.
this. So I'll let
absolutely.
You comment on that.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And that's what's so interesting to me is just how widespread the neuroprotective, you know, the mechanisms that have been reported from these preclinical studies in neurological diseases, neurodegenerative diseases, is really, really variable. The ketogenic diet touches many different aspects of physiology in a way that can elicit these neuroprotective effects. And I think, you know, what you touched on something really important that's very relevant to this paper, that when Parkinson's disease actually occurs, you already have such a substantial amount of neuronal death, it doesn't matter how much you try. If those neurons are dead, you're not going to be able to restore signaling. But if we're able to intervene, you know, before the neurons actually die, rescue them or retain some level of functionality, then, or, you know, extend their lifespan, that could really move the needle. And that's, I think, probably why they saw such a striking difference between just treating the animals for 4 weeks of the ketogenic diet prior to inducing the model versus switching them to the diet literally right after was not good enough to, you know, to show those same therapeutic effects. And I think that this is also relevant to many neurodegenerative diseases. Your brain has trillions of neurons, and you can actually lose a lot of them before there's a lot of redundancy for this reason, so that you can maintain functionality even when neurons have died. I know this also happens in Alzheimer's disease. You can see a substantial amount of neuronal death before you know, the symptoms are extremely present, and I think this is probably true for a lot of neurodegenerative diseases. So focusing our thoughts on prevention and really being able to support and protect the health of neurons before these diseases fully manifest, I think should be the major focus of where these research efforts lie.
Exercise too, you know, yeah. We covered yesterday, not sure when the sequence of these will be released, but
that's like a month ago, Don.
Yeah. We're batching it. But so exercise plays a profound role in reversing or preventing the hippocampal region from, you know, undergoing atrophy. And one could probably assume that the same thing happens with Parkinson's disease, too. Yeah. But the paper, the title of the paper implicated, I believe, the metabotropic glutamate receptors, right? Yeah.
More just a correlation. Like, they saw protection and increased acetylation of that specific gene's promoter region in the substantia nigra samples analyzed.
Yeah, I was actually going to ask something specific to that, just in terms of researchers discussing mGlu-R5 specifically and why that might be an attractive strategy for neuroprotection, neuroinflammation for neuroprotection. If you guys want to kind of dive into that a little bit more. I know, Angela, you touched on that, but it's an interesting, I don't know if Dom, you were going to dive in, but.
Yeah, well, there are many different dopaminergic and glutamatergic receptors, right? So there's the ionotropic receptors, and that's simply when the ligand or the neurotransmitter binds to the receptor, it's essentially a ligand-gated ion channel, where that channel opens and closes and flickers and lets in, depending upon, you know, what receptor it is, it could be calcium, and that mediates a whole cascade of events intracellularly that could be pathological or physiological depending upon the level of activation. So specifically, this is referencing glutamate. With glutamatergic neurotransmission, you have AMPA receptors and then you have NMDA receptors. AMPA receptors only allow sodium to go through, where the NMDA receptors allow calcium and are intricately modulated by a number of different factors, including glycine. There's a glycine coagonist that's resulting in NMDA receptor activation. And this ties into nutrition a little bit, because magnesium, there's a magnesium block in the pore of the NMDA receptor. So from the electrophysiological perspective, when we used to do patch clamp recordings on neurons to look at glutamatergic transport, if you dump in a lot of magnesium, that would buffer or attenuate the hyperexcitability associated with excess glutamatergic transmission, right? So you put in a lot of magnesium and then you lower calcium and you throw on toxic agents that would cause Parkinson's disease, including reactive oxygen species, excess glutamate, and things like that. And then those neurons, and there has been studies done showing that this can be done with Parkinson's disease model neurons, are protected. So magnesium in that case would be protective against the hyperexcitability or neurotoxicity associated with excess glutamate. Okay, so that's the ionotropic glutamate receptors. With the metabotropic glutamate receptors, it's much more highly complex, because the activity when glutamate activates a metabotropic glutamate receptor, a whole host of cascades happen, and it really depends on the different types of neurons that the glutamate receptors are on. If it's on a GABAergic interneuron versus a dopaminergic, you know, neuron, or in different regions of the cell. So,
and specifically these neurons that you're talking about in this, I guess, this specific scenario, activation of that glutamate, metabotropic glutamate receptor, that mGlu-R5, is associated with an anti-inflammatory cascade mediated by phospholipase C and protein kinase C signaling. So they said that if you knock out signaling through that receptor pathway in the substantia nigra, you get this microglial activation that is hallmark of this neuroinflammation in that region. And if you activate it, then you get suppression of that inflammation, that targeted inflammation. And so you know, ketones acting through this epigenetic regulation are able to increase the expression of genes by physically interacting with the histones on the DNA and causing regions of the DNA to open up and be expressed. So causing expression of this gene that then downstream activates these anti-inflammatory pathways, they think is why they saw that reduction in inflammation in that region. So
essentially an epigenetic regulation. And yeah, so this class of glutamatergic receptor would be GPCR, which is G protein coupled receptor. And there is a huge diversity of G protein coupled receptors throughout the body. And many of them actually are targets for immune-based disorders, autoimmune disorders, and even cancer, the metabotropic glutamate receptors. So it's very interesting that, you know, you have a receptor for glutamate that is kind of downstream of this effect, is having some really interesting effects on gene expression. So this class of receptors have been linked physiologically and pathophysiologically to cell proliferation, to autophagy, to cancer growth, and things like that too. So they have a wide array of effects on cell growth, cell cycle, proliferation, and things like that. So it's pretty neat that they have been able to nail this down in some regards, maybe convincingly. Do you think it's convincing? Okay.
I think it's definitely a correlation. It makes sense, you know, that you can kind of draw a line from A to B to C to D here, which is cool. I'm not really sure there's causality established, but it's pretty cool.
It's encouraging for the field of metabolic therapy and prevention specifically, as you were talking about, Angela. I think for those that, you know, of course, are looking at this kind of like from a much higher up sort of view in terms of what this might mean. I mean, this could be something that you could potentially implement years ahead of you know, having to suffer from something like Parkinson's or cancer, or, you know, we're going to be talking about mental illness here too. But I think this kind of research has a lot to say about the potential of disease prevention, which I think, you know, obviously we talk a lot about disease prevention on this podcast, but it's encouraging to see where we could go with something like this for Parkinson's, that there aren't very many options, much like Alzheimer's, much like a lot of other, neurocognitive issues, I think, that are sort of have almost been seen as like, well, we're not really sure what to do next. These kinds of papers, you know, I think bring hope for people. And even though, as you said, Angela, like we're you know, we might not be able to directly apply this to people, it's still a very exciting direction that we're headed.
And there
in
are
this.
Clinical trials, right? Right. These are right. becoming much more common. There's a lot of interest specifically in this field.
Yeah, you hear, actually, I've heard of several anecdotal reports of people with Parkinson's starting a ketogenic diet, where they see improvement with things like tremors. And, you know, there's just so much to it when, Dom, you were mentioning a lot of the mechanisms at play in terms of, you know, the neurocognitive effects or the mechanisms of ketosis specifically. I mean, it's so wide stretching, and probably why you see things like epilepsy and all these other traumatic brain injury and benefits across the board in a variety of places that... I think it's most exciting for brain health specifically, and the application of a ketogenic diet or exogenous ketones show the most promise, in my opinion. And even in things like mental illness, which we're going to get into next, this is probably the area that I'm most just thrilled about, because there are serious mental illnesses out there that... there really aren't much hope and much that people feel like they can do. I think above all else, and a lot of these papers that we talk about, the potential of metabolic therapy gives people this level of potential empowerment that they've not had. And mental illness is something that oftentimes people feel very hopeless and like there's nothing they can do, and they're kind of trapped in this really challenging state. So why don't we dive into mental illness specifically? And we've got an incredible paper here. Actually, Dr. Christopher Palmer was one of the authors, called The Ketogenic Therapy in Serious Mental Illness: Emerging Evidence. And why don't we dive right in? Because this is a really fascinating topic specific to schizophrenia.
So this is a commentary paper, and Dr. Palmer and his colleague wrote this kind of in response to another paper that had come out prior to this in 2020, and this paper came out in 2020, where they were kind of talking about a lot of the mechanisms, potential mechanisms as to why, you know, a ketogenic diet might be beneficial in many of these mental illness conditions. And so they wanted to basically write this commentary to say, hey, let's now, aside from just kind of theorizing about or talking about mechanisms, let's look at what data is there. Now, this is a emerging field, certainly. Not a ton of published research, but a lot of interest and a very quick, I think, increase.
Despite it starting in like 1960, I mean, the first case study or case report was put out, I think, in 1965, if I'm not mistaken, which, you know, here we are, 2022. Our goal is to really put this on a loudspeaker, but.
Yeah. I'd like to add, like, real quick. Well, I know Zoltan Sarnai and Christopher Palmer, they're part of the metabolic psychiatry group, and I've heard them speak and had great conversations with them on many different levels. Mechanistically, Zoltan is super sharp and definitely the leader in the world of understanding ketogenic interventions or metabolic interventions for metabolic psychiatry. And then Christopher Palmer, on the other hand, is also mechanistically understands everything, but is really on the front lines of treating patients. So you have, you know, two authors of this paper who have different experience, but incredible insight into mechanistically and then sort of in the trenches, you know, helping people. I would like to just kind of quickly comment that I was kind of skeptical from the beginning of this years ago, but come to find out that in psychiatric disorders, the go-to drugs are anti-epileptic drugs. Mm-hmm. And these are drugs typically put a Band-Aid or control the symptoms of psychiatric disorders. But mechanistically, they're doing things like elevating GABA and stabilizing and balancing the neuropharmacology in the brain that is actually managing these disorders. So it's important to say that up front, that it could be through bioenergetic mechanisms, neuropharmacology, reactive oxygen species, different things. But mechanistically, it may be working through a similar mechanism that has been, well, is still under investigation in understanding the ketogenic diet and epilepsy. So it's probably working through through that pathway. So
yeah, and if you're kind of in this field, you probably, you know, heard Dom say that and understand really quickly kind of what the implications of that, knowing that the ketogenic diet is a standard of care therapy for refractory epilepsy. But maybe if you're kind of just dipping your toes in this field, you know, the ketogenic diet has been used clinically for over 100 years for epilepsy. And so the longest history of our understanding of the ketogenic diet, its use and how it might work, is coming from this field of epilepsy. And so when you stop and think about the fact that a lot of these psychiatric disorders are treated with epilepsy drugs, then it's it makes a lot of sense that the ketogenic diet could also be applicable there.
And they're they're two disorders that are very refractory to drug treatment. Yeah. So I think that's important to understand.
Yeah. Oh, that's huge, right? If you've got something that's not necessarily as simple as a diet can be difficult to change, but if you have the option of using food when drugs have failed, that's huge what kind of hope that provides for people. And I think this topic is really kind of like the premise of our podcast, The Metabolic Link. I mean, you see depression and mental illness conditions in things like epilepsy, Alzheimer's. I mean, it usually doesn't, one doesn't come without the other, typically, right? Yeah, or obesity, you're at, you know, X amount risk for type 2 diabetes, X amount risk for depression, anxiety. And it's all kind of tied in, and there's this kind of common thread of metabolism throughout that I feel like the field of metabolic psychiatry is really bringing that link to life. And in the words of Dr. Christopher Palmer, you know, mental health, he says mental health is metabolic health, which I think is a very simple but profound statement that I think needs so much more attention and further exploration, which it's exciting to see where the field is going. But yeah, we can get into some of the case studies. Angela, I know you were kind of continuing to dive in a little deeper into what two researchers have
just
to say.
Just so I know, what we're going to go over, I know I've probably seen versions of this paper before, is just ketogenic diet therapy.
Yes,
right?
This is specifically ketogenic diet.
So metabolic therapies can exist as, you know, fasting or time-restricted feeding. And then there are many different types of ketogenic diets. If one particular kind of ketogenic diet, for example, the you know, the classical ketogenic diet, and then you have the, you know, 4-to-1, 3-to-1, 2-to-1, modified Atkins diet, low glycemic index diet. There are different versions, and I think it's important for people to know there are many different versions of a ketogenic diet based upon macronutrient composition and ratios. Mm-hmm. Also, there's many forms of ketogenic diets based upon the composition of the fatty acids, with medium chain triglycerides, for example, which we incorporated when Angela and I developed the ketogenic diet for mice. We were able to double the ketone levels just by increasing the proportion of medium chain fatty acids within. I know there's a lot of research specifically on that too. And then also, is that other types of fatty acids have been talked about by other people in the podcast world. For example, EPA and DHA, docosahexaenoic acid, so omega-3s. So incorporating them into different ratios into the diet could be therapeutic in and of itself, but we think maybe when combined with a ketogenic diet. So I think that's just important to keep in mind, because 20, 30 years ago, early versions of the ketogenic diet were hydrogenated fats and even Crisco. Our
quality matters, right?
types of fats and, you know, these is very important. Fatty acids are signaling molecules. So
absolutely.
Keep that in mind as we review papers. It's important to know. I was reading a couple papers this morning, and the composition of the diet was quite interesting, I would say.
So, I think you're going to see more and more studies like taking that into consideration and focusing on the quality of the foods that participants are consuming, because it we're finding more and more it does make a significant difference if you have damaged fats like you know, vegetable oils or plant-based oils versus something like, you know, good old-fashioned butter and things along those lines. There's a difference there for sure.
Yeah. Okay. So the way this paper is set up is basically they just said, we're going to walk you through some of what's been actually published up until this point in 2020. And so they walked us through a couple of preclinical studies and then also some clinical case reports and case series. So some of the preclinical meaning animal models. So one used a model system that is reflective of the leading mechanistic hypothesis of what is at play in schizophrenia, which is the NMDA receptor hypofunction. So in this model, they used pharmacological inhibition of that of the NMDA glutamate receptors, and that induces basically a model of schizophrenia in animals. And then they provided ketogenic diet for 3 weeks, and they showed that the schizophrenia-like abnormal behaviors were suppressed. So they saw a reduction in the hyperactivity, the stereotyped behavior, decreased sociability, working memory deficits, and the impairment of prepulse inhibition in the startle response of the mice. So that was a large effect in terms of many different features of the schizophrenia model were improved by ketogenic diet. So another study used a different animal model, the DBA2 mice, which is an inbred mouse strain that exhibits a variety of behavioral and metabolic features that also resemble schizophrenia. And they found that ketogenic diet was able to normalize their sensory gating deficits. And this is conceptualized as something fundamental in the development of hallucinatory episodes in people with schizophrenia. So this is something that could be beneficial in terms of reducing that aspect of the disease. They also showed that another study came back and showed back in that NMDA receptor hypofunction model that those results could be recapitulated in female mice. So that original study was only done in males, and then they came back later and said, oh, it also works in the female mice, which is always great. We need to pay attention to all humans and all mice, I guess. And historically, there's been a lot of research done only in male models, which is...
Yeah. Women are underrepresented.
And there's a lot of, thankfully, a big push now to even that out. And interestingly, in that study, they also showed that these therapeutic results could be mimicked by chronic administration of the ketone body beta-hydroxybutyrate. So just the ketone itself, rather than the... actual full ketogenic diet. And that was what they covered for the preclinical models.
Yeah, and we've got some really interesting case studies here too. Dom, were you going to mention something to those preclinical?
I think in teaching, I also teach a schizophrenia and neuropharmacology, and most of it's centered around dopamine. So excess dopamine, antipsychotic drugs, you have the typical antipsychotic drugs like Haldol, very powerful, and then the atypical antipsychotic drugs. These work primarily by blocking the effects of excess dopamine. So in the context of schizophrenia, it's thought to be driven primarily by too much dopamine. And then dopaminergic antagonists are the go-to drugs to prevent manic episodes in like bipolar, but also in schizophrenia. There has been, over the years of teaching this, there has been a lot more evidence to link NMDA receptor. So we were talking about glutamate receptor. So specifically NMDA receptor hypofunction. There are several models of this that implicate, you know, that the etiology of schizophrenia may be linked to that. And schizophrenia, just take a little bit of a step back, is there's a strong genetic correlation. So if you have with monozygotic versus dizygotic twins, for example, it's like up to almost like 50% correlation of schizophrenia with monozygotic, and I think dizygotic maybe like 25%. But if you have a family history of schizophrenia, you are much more likely to have schizophrenia. And then it's a little bit of discussion about the etiology. If it's not, it could be a viral etiology. And some schizophrenic, I just kind of like to add that there are different viral disorders that have been happening that have been linked to schizophrenia like symptoms. So it's there's a clear general consensus within the community of people who treat schizophrenia that it could be initiated, that the etiology could be of a viral origin. And then I think leading into this paper, we know that there's a strong association with excess dopamine, but also the NMDA receptor hypofunction. So just a little bit of background there as we kind of delve
awesome.
More into
Thank
this.
You.
Yeah, which is really interesting. And I want to point out Dr. Christopher Palmer's book and some of the mechanisms and contributors he thinks may be at play in sort of his, you know, theory, if you will, that's very new, brand new. But it touches on some of the points you mentioned, Dom, you know, genetics, epigenetics. He also talks about chemical imbalances, neurotransmitters, hormones and metabolic regulators are at play, inflammation, sleep, light, which we've talked about previously on the podcast, and circadian rhythms, of course, and managing that sort of balance, food, you know, fasting, gut microbiome all come into play, drugs and alcohol and physical activity and just social connection. So it's so interesting when you think, I mean, it's much like some of the new treatments with Alzheimer's are not just focusing on one specific thing, but looking at the person as an organism, as a whole human, and tackling things like environment and lifestyle into the mix, you know, lifestyle interventions. I think it's daunting to think about like all these pieces of the puzzle that might need to be kind of in sync to maybe better manage mental illness. But it's also exciting because many of these things are things that we can control every day. So I'm really excited about where some of these where this field is headed. And there's really exciting case reports that are being published that this paper covers that will kind of dive into, kind of give you a little bit of backstory to some of these individual reports. Actually, Dr. Christopher Palmer, Dr. Westman have put out in the world if you want to take a look at them. And we'll also link them, I might add. We'll link these papers in the description as well. But in 2009, a 70-year-old woman, this is actually something that was published by Dr. Kraft and Dr. Westman. This lady had chronic schizophrenia since her teens, and she was reported to have significantly improved after starting a ketogenic diet for weight loss. But kind of the really wild part is that it happened within 8 days of starting the diet, which if you think about, sometimes some of these people will go, some of them are drug resistant or will try a slew of drugs. fail across the board, continue to have hallucinations and things. This lady started a diet in 8 days and started to see improvement. She reported no hallucinations and improved energy. And after a year, she actually lost about 12 pounds and remained free of hallucinations. So this is something that's completely unheard of. And for somebody listening that's maybe new to the field of metabolic psychiatry, much like Dom, you started out where you're like, I was a little skeptical at first because it sounds
questionable,
yeah. Right? Yeah. It sounds too good to be true, but yeah. These reports are, you know, yeah. This patient interaction is happening. And if you yeah. ever have a chance to listen to Dr. Palmer speak and kind of run through them, it's we actually had the opportunity at Metabolic Health Summit to see him talk yeah. to a patient on stage, which that if you want to watch that presentation, it's available at metabolichealthsummit.com. But that is a really exciting thing to kind of see firsthand, and you start to really understand this has potential to really change the field of mental health. There was another case study actually that Dr. Palmer put out in the world. Two patients with longstanding treatment-resistant schizoaffective disorder who started a ketogenic diet for weight loss. Many of these cases, they start for initial weight loss and to kind of feel better, and then it comes along with a variety of benefits after yeah. the fact. And this in this report, within 2 months of starting the diet, both patients experienced significant reductions in psychotic symptoms as measured by the positive and negative symptom scale. And both patients either purposely or inadvertently stopped the diet, and their psychotic symptoms returned, which is really interesting because this kind of is a very similar on-off effect that you might see in medication as well. So, you know, starting something like a diet or a metabolic therapy, as we like to call it, has the same kind of potential of on and off. If you start the diet, you see maybe a reduction in hallucinations or stop in psychotic symptoms. You restart it again or you stop it and those things come back, much like with epilepsy, right?
Yeah, so a breakthrough seizure.
100%.
I mean, some parents, I mean, it's been reported that simply taking like a multivitamin that has
maltodextrin,
some sugar or,
right.
or maltodextrin in it can actually trigger a seizure simply by that a very small amount. I mean, a gram or so of glucose can trigger a seizure in someone who has treatment resistant, who's managed with a strict ketogenic diet.
Yeah.
So so there's definitely changing the neuropharmacology of your brain, probably not so much brain energy, but probably linked to signaling in the brain,
yeah.
I think,
yeah.
because that amount
mm-hmm.
of glucose is really not going to, like, mm-hmm. you know, alter your, we know that metabolic physiology changes brain energy and the neuropharmacology of your brain, but a tiny amount of glucose, you know, being able to trigger a seizure, this is widely reported and it's not even questioned that this is what's happening. And similar scenario with schizophrenia.
The gut microbiome is an interesting piece to all of this too, right? Like mm-hmm. how I think that's another area that needs to be further kind of explored. I mean, there's been researchers out of UCLA that are really kind of diving into this whole area of the gut microbiome. And when you take out the ketogenic diet, you know, you need that control with the gut microbiome. It has to be present. So there's some research done actually out of UCLA where they essentially had, you know, rats on a ketogenic diet and with a gut microbiome, and then created a sterile environment with rats without a gut microbiome and implemented the ketogenic diet. And of course, these two rats groups they just didn't see seizure control when you took the gut microbiome
That's
piece
right.
out of it.
Mm-hmm.
That was a mouthful of how I explained that just there. Clearly, I am not producing ketones this morning, but it's interesting when you take into that factor that you essentially, in some of this research, need that gut microbiome present in order for the ketogenic diet to have the anti-seizure effect that it does. So then you apply that to something like mental illness or just in what you're saying, like a tiny, teeny amount of carbohydrate into the mix. Mm-hmm. Where does the gut microbiome kind of, what role does that play in all of it? I think probably a pretty significant one, and more than we kind of realize.
Yeah.
So two additional case studies here that I want to mention. The first is a 12-year-old follow-up of the 70-year-old woman that we just recently described. So at age 82, this woman who had suffered from treatment-resistant schizophrenia for 53 years, she remained alive and well on a ketogenic diet. But this is the crazy part. She was off all psychotropic medications for 11 years, including antipsychotic medications and also remained free of psychotic symptoms. So kind of similarly, again, back to epilepsy, people like, you know, Charlie of the Charlie Foundation, yeah. right, went on a ketogenic diet mm-hmm. for, had a horrific form of epilepsy, was having, you know, so many seizures, went on a ketogenic diet for a long duration of time, a few years, got off the ketogenic diet. Those seizures never mm-hmm. came back. Yeah. So similarly with schizophrenia, you see some of this same sort of effect.
And I think specifically in this case, though, she did maintain the ketogenic diet for that right. period of time, right? So she didn't go off. But it sounds
right.
like as long as she maintained, and she lost 150 pounds.
Right.
And she, you know, I mean, that's an incredible, like, change in her life. And, you know, something I think these are incredibly, you know, encouraging case reports. And there's obviously... more and more data coming out every year, but, you know, talking about individuals being able to come off their medications, which yeah. is amazing. And keep in mind, these are patients being actively overseen by their neurologist. And I think in all cases, when, you know, switch, maybe implementing some new therapy, sometimes with diet, people kind of think of it as not being such a strong tool, but ketogenic diet is a medical therapy, and medications and everything need to be managed very closely if it's being implemented for a serious illness. Mm-hmm. And so just pointing out that in a situation like that, if someone is saying, maybe I'm affected by this and I want to try this, it has to be done with oversight because it's not simply just changing your diet for, you know, maybe shed a few pounds. It really has, like, very, you know, serious, like, medical effects.
There's dramatic effects.
It has to be done.
Blood pressure, too. Yeah, in many cases, you have to deprescribe.
Yeah.
And if the patient loses that much weight, is going into it with high blood glucose, high blood pressure, and loses, like, 150 pounds, the ketogenic diet, even independent of weight loss, can drop your blood pressure pretty fast. But if your blood pressure is under control with medication and you maintain that same amount of medication, and you have this kind of metabolic effects, then you're going to have dangerously low blood pressure typically. So
similarly with insulin and, you know, diabetics, where they start a ketogenic diet and, you know, they can't necessarily stay on the same dose when you're implementing something as powerful as metabolic therapy like the ketogenic
diet.
Insulin
has to be reduced very quickly, and that needs to be done with their
in close connection with a doctor for sure. And, you know, in mentioning, of course, Charlie's case where he came off of the ketogenic diet, that I feel like, at least from the research that we've been seeing or the case reports that we've been seeing and in hearing Dr. Christopher Palmer speak, typically you have more of this on-off type of effect when dealing with something like mental illness, where a lot of his patients, as soon as they come off of a ketogenic diet or slip up or what have you, they start to have those psychotic episodes again.
Yeah.
So it's different from epilepsy. And obviously there's so much to learn, but at the end of the day, as Angela has mentioned, really important to work with your doctor if you're dealing with something serious like schizophrenia or other serious mental illnesses, because even just that transition onto a ketogenic diet and the shift in, you know, fluid drop in electrolytes and things along those lines can trigger things for people dealing with something like mental health issues.
Yeah. And not all epilepsy patients can get off of the ketogenic diet, but there are high responders, term super responders like Charlie, who I think it's maybe 10 to 15% when they're on it as a pediatric patient, that they can transition off and be completely fine even without medication and be managed. So I think in talking with some of the experts, including Dr. Palmer, he does not think that's going to be the case for psychiatric disorders, that some level of maintenance, maybe a modification of the diet, would need to be maintained.
Right, absolutely. The final case I just want to briefly mention is a 39-year-old woman who had suffered from treatment-resistant psychotic symptoms for 20 years. She started the ketogenic diet at the instruction of her medical practitioner, and after several months, she experienced complete remission of her psychotic symptoms again. So This is a really exciting potential therapy that is something, you know, if you talk to Dr. Palmer, who has implemented this time and time again, it is doable. It, you know, he's shown patients who literally have not been able to function in society, being able to transition with the right support, being able to transition onto this metabolic therapy. Is doable. And, you know, a lot of times you hear like, oh, it's not feasible, patients aren't compliant, all of those things. But I think with the right tools and the right mindset about it and the right kind of support, this is totally doable, even for somebody with a serious mental illness, which is exciting because it's food. And if you fail drugs, but you have the option to go and pick different things from your fridge, that could be a huge amount of hope that you're bringing into somebody's life who didn't have it otherwise.
It's going to be challenging. It is doable.
Yes, it
and
is
that
going
was
to be.
A topic of the conversation of a meeting recently. And I personally feel that three things need to happen for this to be successfully implemented. One is to have prepackaged, standardized, whole food ketogenic meal services. So we know entrepreneurs are scrambling to this area to provide therapeutic ketogenic diets. The second thing would really be to have a monitoring system, like a continuous glucose, but probably more important, a continuous ketone monitoring system where the data could go be detected by a sensor, go to the smartphone, and go to a cloud where the treating physician or registered dietitian could have oversight and a metabolic snapshot of that patient's dietary adherence. And the third thing, really, and I think this comes from the bottom up, but it's like patients would really need to have 24-hour access to, through an app or whatever, access to a dietitian, because they're going to have questions when they start implementing this, probably more so in the first month to 2 months. But I think those three things need to happen, like a meal service, ketogenic meal service, and then monitoring systems, and then that patient resource and feedback for the patient when they had questions.
I think that's a really great summary of what you need. I you know, in working with patients myself in a variety of pilot studies that I did with a nonprofit organization involved in research with metabolic therapy for cancer specifically, those were essentially the pillars where, you know, if you've got and having a monitoring system too that would essentially ping the team when they popped out of ketosis or their blood sugar shot up or what have you. That's really a high touch point kind of setup, I think, is key. But having the right support too, you know, myself and a dietitian were, you know, essentially on call working with a lot of these patients, because you think about it, it's really difficult to go through a diagnosis, like a traumatic diagnosis of something like cancer or battling for, you know, a lifetime with something like mental illness or what have you. It's really difficult to go through some of the grief and the struggles around just the diagnosis in and of itself to then change your lifestyle completely. Like you said, Dom, you really need a solid support system, a solid way of tracking. And, you know, also, too, I think mindset is a huge, like, the approach of whoever the dietitian is and the nutritionist in taking a positive mindset around it, making it something that the patient can really be a proactive member and make choices and learn in the process and get excited when they see the results on their blood meter. I think that motivational piece is also key. And a lot of what I used to train athletes back in the day, and a lot of what we took from implementing nutrition protocols with athletes, it sounds strange, but applying that same motivation mindset to patients was key in getting them excited to be a part of their treatment program. Yeah. So these are just some other points for those who are actually implementing these therapies, I think are important to keep in mind.
Yeah, and to be inclusive, I think we need to also focus on the caretakers and then the parents of families. So, you know, we communicate with a number of different parents. One that has Pomp syndrome, shout out to Pomp Warrior Foundation. So, you know, and a number of different parents that are managing children who have a particular disorder that's managed with a ketogenic diet. So having a food service, having monitoring systems, and having access to 24/7 access to being able to ask questions would be a huge burden that's lifted from parents and caretakers, and it could be for Alzheimer's caretakers or cancer. Communicate quite often with cancer caretakers too. So yeah, these services need to be established, and when they do, we're going to get much better data in clinical trials that should be done. Surprisingly, it's not done in clinical trials. It's got to be done in clinical trials to get great data, but it needs to transition over to the world of ketogenic therapies outside of the research world.
Yeah, 100%. There's a lot of work to be done for sure in this field, but I feel like we're finally making some good progress. You know, I think the first case study or case report that I kind of touched on was like 1965. So if you think about how much time has passed and how much work needs to be done, I mean, while it's exciting, there's just, I think you're going to really see the field of metabolic psychiatry explode. I think we're really starting to take this very seriously and understand that this metabolism needs to be a part of the conversation when we're dealing with, especially in serious mental illness where you don't have a lot of options, or those treatment options maybe aren't as effective as we would like. I think that this has got a lot of exciting promise. And so we will certainly be keeping a finger on the pulse of the metabolic psychiatry field, because it's ever changing and growing and exciting. And thank you guys today for chatting this great neuro discussion all around. And thank you all for joining us. Make sure to like, leave us a review, comment, follow, subscribe on all the places that you get your Metabolic Link podcast. Please leave us a review if you like this podcast, because that's how we get into the ears of other people, ears and eyes of other people. And until next time, we'll see you guys soon. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.